Welcome to episode 18 of The Infectious Myth. I hope you're enjoying this series of interviews and discussions as much as me. Today I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Simon Silver of the University of Illinois at Chicago, who recently wrote a review article entitled Beyond the Fringe, When Science Moves from Innovative to Nonsense. Before I get to Dr. Silver, I'd just like to remind you to email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com if you have praise, insults, or suggestions for future guests. If you're interested in being a sponsor of this show, definitely contact me. We've talked on this show with scientists who've had varying difficulties getting their work funded or published. Dr. Silver's paper mentions the famous lecture of Irving Langmuir in 1953 in which he described pathological science, science that everyone but the researchers themselves can see is just crazy. Dr. Silver, are you with us?
Yes.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Can I just call you Simon for simplicity?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you. That helps. I probably trip over Simon
That's
Silver.
What my children and my students and everyone. Okay.
Yes, yes. So you got your PhD in 1962 from MIT. This is a very brief biography. You're the editor of three microbiology journals and on the board of three more. It seems like your interest is in the response of bacteria to metals, both when humans want to control the bacteria and also from the environmental aspects, such as the pollution from mercury in Japan's infamous Minamata Bay. And I'll put a link to your full bio webpage at the University of Illinois at Chicago on the show notes. So welcome to the show. Now, you said that this kind of science is, quote, quickly recognized by the peer community of snake oil, and specifically in your field of microbiology, microbiology has experienced examples of highly productive researchers who have gone beyond just interpreting their experimental results with hypotheses and published nonsense. So can you describe a little bit about a couple of the examples in your paper that you felt were obvious nonsense but got published anyway?
Well, I covered five, mm-hmm. And limited to microbiology and immunology, not so much because what I had seen was limited, but because it was a microbiology journal that asked for this paper.
Okay.
The five included one rather more recent Lamarckian ideas about genetics and inheritance, and that most infamously included the Lysenko, I don't know what you call it, disaster in the Soviet Union that went on and on and on. So number one was Lamarckian inheritance.
And can I just maybe explain for our listeners who might not be familiar, Lamarck believed that you could acquire characteristics through the environmental impact of the organism's life. So if an organism lived in a cold area, then the offspring would be more suitable to cold climates, and if it lived in a hot area, they'd be more suitable to hot climates. And Lysenko was a scientist in Russia who basically got the government to impose these views on other scientists, so you weren't allowed to discuss natural selection, for example, which is another theory about how things evolve. Is that about accurate?
Fair enough. Lamarck was 200 years ago, really 200 years ago. So when he proposed that we learn from the environment around us and pass it on to our children, that was perfectly reasonable. Once we had genetics with Mendel, 60, 70 years later, we had the genetics as we understand it now, that we have genes that determine our capacities, and that's how it works. And then Lysenko was not to me a scientist. He was a political hack in the Soviet Union under the time of Stalin, and people got killed if they disagreed with him in public supposedly scientific dispute. He basically destroyed Soviet genetics. And then it continued on, more relevant to you now. So this has a long history. In England, in the 1960s when I first went there, and in Massachusetts in maybe the 1980s, when I was around also, that people said that genes and getting genes from our ancestors were what determined inheritance, to an idea that if we want a particular property, I remember at a Russian genetics congress, they wanted animals that would not bite and harm the mink skins, that would be more friendly to the mink export industry. Then you could just tell them, you know, this is what we want, this is what we're going to get.
Right. But I was a little bit confused about this point, because isn't there a whole new science called epigenetics that just basic sounds pretty
You and I talked about this a little bit. It's a whole old science called epigenetics, and there's no problem there at all. Epigenetics has long been real. When I was in elementary school or junior high school, there was a wonderful guy in Indiana, Tracy Sonneborn, who studied epigenetics. Never a problem. Complicated, but never a problem in terms of reality versus rubbish.
Right.
And epigenetics now is perfectly reasonable, and it's a mistake to mix epigenetics with Lamarckian inheritance, because one is real, the other is wrong.
Okay, so let me try to define epigenetics. So it's the observation that when the germ cells are you know, form a new life, that it's not just the DNA that gets transferred, it's also the cytoplasm, mostly of the egg, but a little bit from the sperm, presumably, and also mitochondria get transferred, and who knows what else. But
it's kind of technical, but what you just said was a bit erroneous, and you and I talked a little before. I tend to come in sharply. Epigenetics is that it's not just the genes, but the genes sometimes turn on and sometimes turn off. There's methylation and histones, and the DNA, the Watson-Crick double-stranded DNA, does not exist in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
It functions in a milieu, the cell, with all sorts of other things going on and affecting its expression or not expression. That's epigenetics. These all sorts of other things.
But aren't the things outside the DNA possibly influenced by the life of the organism? So, I mean, isn't that slightly Lamarckian in its way of looking at genetics?
Oh, it's absolutely influenced by the life of the organism, and no, it isn't Lamarckian at all. Lamarckian must be about 1810. I'm not good at my dates. 200 years ago.
Long time ago.
Right. And epigenetics, in my understanding, where I learned it in the late 50s. Now, that's already, as my wife likes to say, year old, half a century ago. So epigenetics is not new. It's at least a half a century old, and it's absolutely splendid science.
Okay, so in this case that you, I like to talk about this because I know a little bit more about evolution and things like that than I do about a lot of the other things you talk about. But in this case, you had bacteria that presumably had been bred somehow that they did not have lactose fermenting capabilities, and these scientists said that if you put them in a high lactose environment, that they would develop these on their own without actually having had the DNA in them.
For your purposes today, let me tell a story. When I was a graduate student in S.E. Lurie's, Lurie got a Nobel Prize for mutation, understanding mutation, lab. A Lysenkoan book came out from Hungary where every day they autoclaved to kill typhoid and fed the dead typhoid to E. coli, a harmless lab bacteria. And over a year, they taught E. coli how to cause typhoid. You could teach as opposed to mutation and selection. And teaching becomes, in this context of heredity, a bad word because it just doesn't happen.
Right. So you felt that this science on bacteria was so bad that everybody should have been able to recognize it. The scientists themselves.
Absolutely. I was a graduate student, and I thought, you know, one day the autoclave failed, or they contaminated it, and some typhoid got through. Why not? They had a whole year of doing this every day, and there was no way that they could or did control about it. All they knew was that after a year, they had taught E. coli how to cause the disease typhoid, which is rubbish. And if they had tried to isolate the strain that caused typhoid, they would have found it wasn't E. coli.
It was a typhoid bacteria,
I assume, because they never did that experiment. And E. coli and typhoid have been separate for 300 million years of evolution. It's absolutely easy to tell the difference between a mouse and an elephant.
Okay, so that, you think that was a case of basically laboratory contamination and nobody thought to
check? Well, I mean, that was the best guess. Nobody will ever know.
Right, so it's hard to say until those people do the experiments that it absolutely wasn't true.
In the case we described, there were two in my lifetime. One was in Cyril Hinchelwood's laboratory in Oxford, England, and a guy then in London, later in Edinburgh, repeated the experiments and explained how they happened. And they were totally different from Hinchelwood's explanation, which was wrong. And the other was what I consider my friend and teacher, in a way, John Cairns, who's still alive now in his maybe early 90s, and was at that time a professor of public health at Harvard Medical Center. And John, I tried to talk him out of it on a long car drive once against publishing it before it was published, because it was easy to see that it was nonsense. And there were maybe 25 or 30 papers, five or six from friends of his who tried to explain, well, it wasn't all wrong, it was only 90% wrong. And then 90% of the papers explained how John Cairns messed up. Now, he's a wonderful guy and has did really some amazingly admirable stuff.
Well,
but
I mean,
he screwed up.
Right, you pointed out that Irving Langmuir, who gave a speech about pathological science in 1953, also described a protein structure that later proved to be wrong. So
accuracy is always a merit in newspapers and radio and publication as well as in science. And Langmuir wasn't wrong himself, but he supported a person, and she was really badly wrong.
Okay, so to go a little further into how we sort of deal with this, I'll read another quote from your paper. Responsibility for beyond the fringe science lies entirely with authors. Nevertheless, additional responsibility of the journal is not a simple question. Sometimes the potential of a beyond the fringe problem is not recognized immediately by in-house professional journal editors who lack related laboratory experience, et cetera. Then the outside peer reviewers miss the point. And then you specifically criticize the journals Nature and Science, who are always seeking innovative work, and you say often give space to beyond the fringe science. So whose responsibility is it to stop this science from getting published?
We are humans, and science is a very human activity. So whose response? There is a process, and the process usually works, but sometimes it doesn't. This week, yesterday, to my pleasure, I think I rescued a paper that I was one of the three anonymous reviewers, mm-hmm. and the two other anonymous reviewers just said to turn it down. And I said it was maybe the best I've seen of the last 20 in this area. And so okay. Then the editor has to decide, you going to listen to?
Right. The process basically is three steps. Like the scientist says, I want to publish this. The journal could reject it out of hand, or they could send it to peer reviewers who may reject it. Is that basically the sequence?
Okay. The process goes from before that till after that. So you've got right. most of the middle. And I've published, more than a couple hundred papers myself. Mm-hmm. So I have different. Each has a different experience,
right.
and been involved in the editing of thousands. So initially, you decide what experiments to do, of course, and that's then when you write it up. You decide where to submit it, mm-hmm. and there are major questions of where you should submit it or not.
Right.
The first part of my PhD thesis to be published was submitted by my teacher, Luria, who I right. told you was very anti-Lysenko, to the journal Nature. And it was never went through the steps you said. It was
okay.
immediately accepted without peer review.
Oh, and does that still happen?
A little bit more paperwork, but effectively, Nature and Science have sort of favorite subjects and favorite groups of authors, and these are subject to a much less careful process. And that was part of the mess up. I don't know what language you want. Can I say screw up repeatedly or not?
Yeah, you can be reasonably impolite. I think okay. there's certain words.
So that was part of the screw up on the arsenic in DNA thing. This was the sixth paper from favored people, authors who are favored.
Okay.
And my teachers were very favored. And so I could describe it to you at greater length, this just amazing early experience where it didn't get reviewed at all. It just came back as page proofs.
Right. Wow, amazing.
Watson and Crick, all your listeners understand the Watson and Crick paper.
The DNA papers, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In 1953, before right. my time, before your time, that was not reviewed. If you think
okay.
about it, there was almost nobody who could review it except people who already knew about it. And when Bragg, who was head of their institute, submitted it, it wasn't Watson and Crick who submitted it. It wasn't their immediate bosses, Kendrew and Perutz. It was Bragg, who was head of the institute, submitted it. Nature was going to publish whatever Bragg submitted.
Oh, okay. So it could have been junk, but it would have got published.
We're glad it did. Yeah.
Yes. I guess one of my concerns is I know in statistics they have the concept of, I think they're called alpha and beta errors. So it seems like we have a dichotomy between we can allow junk to be published and also things that are so innovative that peer reviewers can't understand them, or we can reject more junk, but we may also reject more innovation. I mean, are you concerned about that happening if people sort of start looking for junk science and preventing it from being published?
Not really. I'm concerned about something else, that young people who are getting into science, and most of us who are running in the middle, should be more aware of the possibility and the existence of junk science. But I think the mistakes are made relatively few in number and at little cost. I mean, of the 25 approximately papers of mine that have been rejected, those include maybe five of the most innovative things we've ever done. So the more innovative it is, the more likely it's going to be turned down.
Science published some comments from the National Academy of Science, a panel on peer review that had some comments such as, I've been on study sections and have seen members who clearly lack expertise review proposals and grade proposals in a biased or self-serving manner.
Correct.
The AIDS and related research study section was composed of individuals with widely different areas of expertise. For the most part, we couldn't understand the reviews written by other members of the panel.
Correct. And then, I've seen that. Yeah.
And then another one, under the present culture, in quotes, which focuses on fault finding and amplification of minor errors and discouraging innovative research, nearly all NIH funding has gone into confirming, reconfirming, and reinventing what is already known by individuals of very little insight or talent.
I'd say that substantially differently. A failure over recent years of NIH science and Canadian science, and I have an Australian grant proposal in front of me for today, is that it tends to be much more cautious and ass-protecting, so that to dig deeper on things that are already understood in a broad way is favored, and to do what the government science agencies used to call blue sky science, which a real gamble, is almost impossible. And on grant panels nowadays, so I see both sides of this. It's almost like an old-fashioned American college sorority. One right. black ball and you're out.
Right.
So the processes of grant funding, I think, is deteriorated globally in all countries that I know to a much less good process. But journal publishing, which is what you're asking about now, still has some problems, but is much more sound, I think.
What's the difference between peer review for publication and peer review for grant funding?
Oh, it's incredibly different. I mean, to call them both peer review, that's the only thing in common. You've just said that the peer review for grants, according to this report you read, was not being done by peers, but by people who fundamentally didn't understand it.
Right.
Grant proposal. May I tell another story? I think in terms of stories, I was once on an American federal grant panel, and there were lots of bacterial proposals,
right.
and I'm a bacterial person,
mm-hmm.
And I was assigned ones on acid rain killing forests and frogs dying out in ponds in the northeast of North America.
Okay.
And I asked the person why I wasn't, and the person making the assignments, who was not a scientist but an apparatchik, you know,
right.
a political appointee, sort
right.
of a contractor. I'm talking
that.
I'm talking about a contractor in suburban Washington D.C.
Okay.
Said I would be biased about anything that I knew about.
Oh, I see. So
and therefore, to be fair and neutral.
Maybe they should democratize it and just, like, put it in random mailboxes.
That's close to what they were suggesting. Now, when I get a paper as a journal editor, my job upfront initially is who in who best in the world might understand this and tell me is it good or not good and how it could be better, maybe.
Right, so you want an expert in the field to review the papers.
Absolutely.
You first make a decision that you presumably reject a lot of stuff that you
no.
get.
No, 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 no. That's important. And again, this is not as simple as, you know, I've spent a whole long life doing this every day.
Right.
No, when papers come into the most of the journals, Science and Nature Cell are exceptions. They almost all go out for a review. And
okay.
I have seldom in the thousands of experiences ever turned down something without review. And when I do that, I write a letter saying, Dear Dr. Smith, I've considered sending this out for review and chosen peer reviewers, but I know their science and what's in your manuscript, and I don't think this has any hope at all.
Okay.
And therefore, I think it's a misuse of the peer reviewer's time, and it's not to your benefit.
Right.
To convert peer review to pure Las Vegas gambling is not good. Now, Science and Nature don't do this. They initially have to throw away 90% of the manuscripts based on a short, it's about an hour long, reading by someone whose job is not to be a peer, but to be a full-time paid employee of the journal.
Right.
Who has a good scientific background, but is not doing science anymore.
Right, right.
Not doing laboratory science anymore.
It's funny you mentioned Las Vegas, because there was a paper in the journal Brain in 2000 that said that the agreement between reviewers in clinical neuroscience was little greater than would be expected by chance alone.
Yeah.
Basically saying that peer review is almost a random process. And in a Cochrane review in 2003 said that there's no scientific evidence that peer review works.
Now, it varies from subject to subject hugely, of course. And I'd like to hope that the hard sciences, that's not my phrase, have a better track record, and you could get good statistics, whereas the quote-unquote softer sciences have a worse track record. And indeed, there have been some experiments done by sending out manuscripts at random to a whole bunch of journals and see if it's anything better than a random process.
Right. Well, there was one paper that I read where, let me see if I can, just a second, I'll find it here. Yes, this is quite humorous. On the 4th of July, good news arrived in the inbox of Akarufu Kobange, a biologist at the Wasi Institute of Medicine in Asmara. It was the official letter of acceptance for a paper he had submitted 2 months earlier, describing the anti-cancer properties of a chemical extracted from lichens. In fact, it should have been promptly rejected. Any reviewer with more than a high school knowledge of chemistry and the ability to understand a basic data plot should have spotted the paper's shortcomings. Its experiments are so hopelessly flawed that the results are meaningless. I know because I wrote the paper. Akafuru Kobangi does not exist, nor does the Wasi Institute of Medicine. So there seems to be a little bit of a game going on where people write papers which are
rather more clinical subjects have a different ambience, if you wish, and a different experience what are called basic science papers, but although there's a transition between them, and certainly cancer papers. And then it depends on the journal. Even within a subject matter, some journals are much more stringent And some journals are much more professional, and some I think are much more terrible.
Right. But I guess the one of the problems is that innovative science could be rejected, and what you're saying is it sometimes
oh,
is.
Oh, it does get rejected.
And like, for example, Einstein got some of his science rejected.
I wasn't around.
It was 1905.
And of course, he couldn't get a job. He went to work in the patent agencies in Switzerland because he couldn't get a job.
Yes.
But I'm not sure that was wrong.
Actually, Einstein
was accepted after, is it the miracle year, 110 years ago, when he wrote several miraculous papers, and within less than a year, he had gone to sort of a fringe guy to right in the middle. They invited to Berlin and made the famous person we all know about.
Right. Actually, I'm not sure I'm correct on that he got his papers rejected. It just says that as a patent clerk, he got a really bad performance review. But this paper, which is in the area of computer science, notes that many of the major advances in computer science were rejected by major journals upon first submission because they were so different, and they broke the so-called rules.
This happens for fiction, for poetry, for novels as well. It's a human activity.
And so wouldn't it make sense that we should then celebrate that some junk gets published, because what that means is that if somebody comes up with something innovative, there's a greater chance of it getting published?
No. Because the amount of wasted time and clarifying these, two or three of those of the five I listed, I've watched years and years and years of wasted time of very bright, capable people as a result of it. I'm told a story here that I'm only told a story, so I don't know it's true, of a guy giving a seminar in this building I'm sitting in, saying that he was unable to reproduce work that all of us here already knew was not reproducible, and some of us, not me, were absolutely sure was cheating. And during the talk, nobody told him, yes, everybody knows that can't be reproduced. It was just wasting time.
But if there's science that's being published that somebody feels is wrong or fraudulent or something like that, isn't it really important to try to replicate it and show that it can't be replicated?
Well, you've read Thomas Kuhn,
yeah.
And so have I. I was given it. The wonderful Thomas Kuhn book when I was an assistant professor by a senior postdoc in my lab because he wanted to straighten me out, and
right.
I loved it. And Kuhn says it does not get corrected by replication. It's just that the people with the nutty ideas get more and more marginalized, and then they eventually stop one way or another, and people go on with the ideas that are more accepted, is not a word I like, ring true. And the nature of scientific revolutions, which was Kuhn's subject more than 50 years ago, is not that they get replicated, but that they disappear.
But that often happens with innovative ideas. Like I gave you the example when we talked before of continental drift, which was banished from
Was it banished? But it sure was marginalized. Nobody thought about it for a whole long time.
Well, people thought about it, but it was there's a good book by Naomi Oreskes from around the year 2000, and she describes how it was banned, that if you were a geology professor or student and you mentioned the word continental drift, that was a career-ending move. And then the overthrowing of the banishment of continental drift did not occur because geologists were investigating it. They couldn't. It occurred because the U.S. military was looking at the magnetism on the Atlantic sea floor and came up with results that could not be explained by static continents. So didn't that put back geological science by maybe 40 or 50 years by refusing to take this crazy idea that the continents float around the planet?
I do not know. I know what continental drift is, but I don't know it's... it seems so self-evident now, but I don't know enough about its history to know it. One of my references in that article that brought me to your attention is a book by Mike Friedlander titled At the Fringes of Science. And Mike is a physics professor at Washington University in St. Louis and someone who has worked as more as an educator, I think, than as a bench doing the science himself.
Right.
There are not so as many career-making moves as I think as you seem to fear. There are certainly career-endangering moves. In his department, there was one example. This was physics again, and continental drift is, of course, geophysics. And there was a guy in Friedlander's department, Peter Phillips, I can name him, who was a tenured professor of experimental physics, who believed in extrasensory perception, transmission of information and auras and almost neural processes across space without any of our familiar physical things.
Right.
And Peter was one of a few people who was tricked by Randy the magician, who brought in people and liked to show the wrongness of some nonsensical science. Peter remained as a professor. He was tenured. That does not mean the National Science Foundation should give him grants for doing nonsense because it was imaginative.
Right.
So I didn't get to stay in Berkeley, California for several reasons, one of which I was studying membranes as a virologist, and virologists were supposed to be studying nucleic acids and proteins then. I did not fit what my older supervisors thought made sense.
Well, it's good that you brought up Berkeley, because I was going to ask you what you thought of the treatment of Peter Duisberg, who published an article in 1987 saying that retroviruses as a whole, including HIV, could not cause disease. And at that point, he lost all his government grants.
Again, I'm sorry. You've got to be exact. When he put in a new proposal, if the proposal didn't get through the peer review, and I think the NIH peer review process is not good, I don't like it, then it didn't get refunded. He didn't lose it. He didn't lose any grants, as far as I'm aware. It's that he stopped getting new ones.
Okay, you're correct.
It's not
the
same.
He lost the ability to get new grants, and he had great difficulty getting anything published. He apparently had the right to publish in PNAS, Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, and even there the editors strongly resisted his request to publish.
And I think that the editors were correct because they had a precedent. Do you know Shockley, who I think had two Nobel Prizes, transistors? Now, Shockley published in PNAS showing, and it's politically incorrect and horrible now in 2014 to say it, Shockley published that blacks were less intelligent than whites.
Right.
And that if you judged how much black they were by skin color, light-skinned blacks were somewhere in the middle, and he did a small amount of trivial mathematics and said there was 1.6%, 1.6 IQ points per 10% Afro-American blood. Now, this was garbage that was published in PNAS and made PNAS changed its processes. I taught this that year to a huge genetics class at Washington University where I was, and a series of the Afro-American students in the room went to the dean and protested and wanted me to get fired. Neither Shockley nor I got fired, but we both paid a price.
All right. But going back to Peter Duisberg, he made a lot of criticisms of the mainstream HIV-AIDS theory, not just that HIV couldn't cause AIDS, but he also was very critical of the nucleoside analog AZT.
I think Peter was wrong.
So you think that a nucleoside analog can be effective?
Well, let's go to the beginning and then move forward. Peter kept his job and kept publishing, but he didn't get new grants, and he's still there now. I invited Peter, whom I've known, because we were in the same building in Berkeley in the middle 60s. I invited him here, and he gave two excellent lectures, one on his theory of cancer, which is different from everybody else's, and that's what he has trouble getting grants on.
Aneuploidy theory.
And the second, yes. And the second was on HIV causing this immune deficiency disease, AIDS, or not. And both were excellent lectures, and I invited him to the University of Illinois College of Medicine to give them. He was well and politely received, and people were very, very interested in hearing him.
But you
1987, the same year that you're saying Peter published his paper, I didn't remember the year, against the HIV causing the disease AIDS. I, for the first time, gave that lecture to the medical students here in the University of Illinois College of Medicine, and the students said, wow. And I gave that as a bacterial person because the virologists just weren't interested.
So I missed something there.
I think it's a much more open system than you're suggesting. Peter burned himself into a corner, which was very, very non-productive for the last, what is it now, more than 25 years. But it wasn't, nobody did anything wrong to Duisberg as far as I'm aware, and he was treated rather well, as I think the universities and journals usually do pretty well, not badly.
Well, you said he could still publish, but that's not really true.
He can only publish in places I wouldn't really want to publish.
Right. So he could only publish in lower echelon journals. He had to fight to get the standard salary increments that every other professor got.
I don't think every other professor gets them. At the University of Illinois, the department head has complete and free option to give salary increments or not. More on politics and whims than on merit.
Yeah.
I'm sad to agree.
So you don't object to the treatment of him, and yet you invited him to talk at UIC.
I don't object to how Peter's last 20 years have progressed. At the beginning, in the mid-60s, when HIV and AIDS were rather new.
80s.
Sorry?
80s.
I'm sorry, you're correct. I made a mistake. Thank you. I like to be corrected. In the mid-80s, when it was rather new, it was much more meriting of open consideration. By the 90s or so, when it was much more clear that there was a virus that does cause a disease, although you don't die from the virus, you might die from tuberculosis or a cancer or, you know, other things, then Peter had much less claim. Peter Duisberg had much more less reason to claim that everyone should give him an open hearing, because it was already old stuff and we had moved on. In the 2014, the interesting question is, are there new drugs and combination drugs? And, you know, in anticipation of today, I printed something from the New York Times, 18th of June, that's last week, and the headline says, "Is a pill enough to fight HIV?" So we've moved on. That's what we want. We don't want ask, does HIV cause AIDS? We want to ask, is this new proposed pill, is that going to be it for tomorrow?
Right, but he was cut off in 1987, and the press
He was not cut off. He was slow, but not very slow, decline, and his funding had to do more with the aneuploidy, because as far as I know, Duisberg did not, from listening to him and reading him, I wasn't there, he did not seek grants for alternative hypotheses for HIV. I don't think Duisberg ever studied HIV. He studied, was it Rouse sarcoma?
He studied
other
viruses.
Other viruses, yeah.
Yes, but he did put in multiple grant applications related to HIV and AIDS.
How related were they? To study the virus HIV itself?
That's, I guess, well, before 1987, he had never had a grant application turned down, which is pretty remarkable. And then after 1987...
No, not at all. He was very much fast-track, young, very bright. Mm-hmm. He got into the National Academy of Sciences, which is very prestigious, very young. I mean, he was a fast-track high flyer.
Yeah.
And then he... He made a mistake. Excuse me?
He wrote one paper, and the lights
No, it
off.
Was more than one paper. He spent all of his, he switched his time and energy to something which people thought was nonsense.
But that was only 1987. What do you think about Robert Gallo in 1984 announcing with the head of Human and Health Services that HIV was the probable cause of AIDS before he'd published any papers in the journal Science? It was several weeks later that the first papers were published.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Now, I know of and both of them only slightly, and Duisberg is a quiet, thoughtful guy. And so I have, that gives me, and he's bright, incredibly bright. So I have great tolerance for Peter Duisberg. Robert Gallo is a manipulator, grandiose, you know, like leader of a team. And so I have much less, you know, I mean, Robert Gallo did some remarkably important work, and we can talk, we can describe it, but he's not a nice guy. He's a pain in the butt of those around him and has apparently always been. He eventually got pushed out of NIH,
right,
And now he's at the University of Maryland in Baltimore.
But in the process, let's just talk about the process. Like what do you think about the process of standing up at a press conference saying we've made this major scientific discovery and in a few weeks we'll publish the first information about it? Like, what do you think about that as a process?
There was a huge, for every disease, more recently, chronic fatigue syndrome virus, mm-hmm. which undoubtedly you know, but your
right.
listeners don't. So there is, when there is a disease, then there's a huge community of people who are suffering from the
right.
disease. And there were at that time a large community of people who were dying of AIDS. And so to give them some kind of a hope is understandable.
So you think
I don't know if he was proper or not proper. I think it's not unprecedented. It happened before, and it's happening today.
You criticize in one of your other examples, maybe two of them, the direct water with memory and electronic waves in bacteria.
Yeah,
they're both a little bit related to the man who got the Nobel Prize for HIV.
No. The second one is the electronic electromagnetic wave signals cause
okay.
of microbial pathogenicity is by the guy who got the Nobel Prize for the virus HIV, and
right.
Gallo didn't get it because some people can argue Gallo stole the virus. I think the consensus is that Gallo got the virus out of the samples that had been sent to him from Paris. He didn't isolate it himself.
But Luc Montagnier said in 1997, we did not purify HIV, and I think he said something like, after a Roman effort, we were unable. And
I don't remember this, but Gallo did, and a test became available, and Gallo announced, yeah, so yes, Gallo made, wasn't first, but he was fishing in the same pond for a long time before, and Gallo made major contributions.
Right, but he didn't purify HIV either, because nobody's purified HIV.
Well, our friend, I think my friend and your friend, Andrew Maniotis, says you can't purify it because it's an artifact and it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. When you talk about nonsense screwball science, going back hundreds and hundreds of years, maybe to the Greeks and Egyptians, there are different levels of being wrong. There are different levels of being wrong.
Right. I mean, have you seen papers where you believe that HIV has been isolated and purified?
Oh, absolutely. There's a guy who was in this department about 30 feet from me for a whole bunch of years, Thomas Hope, H-O-P-E.
Mm.
He's now at Northwestern Medical School, and he is amongst the people whom I know, you know, to drink a beer with. Our local HIV expert, and I think Tom Hope thinks that what you and I are doing today is wasting an hour on the telephone that would be better that I would be better spent doing science.
Well, in
there are lots of people who have HIV virus.
Well, there's lots of people who have positive antibody tests, but I guess...
No. You know, lots of researchers who have HIV virus in the lab. And then there are, of course, lots of people patients who have anti-HIV antibodies, but maybe no disease.
Right, but when I have chickenpox antibodies, that nobody's telling me I have the virus in my body because I got rid of it, right? But so why should this same not be true for HIV? I mean, isn't that a strange phenomenon that with HIV the antibodies?
Not strange at all. Perfectly normal. My wife has tuberculosis, mycobacteria tuberculosis antibodies, as many people born and raised where she was do, and very few of them have any disease or any symptoms. I was a kid, there were at least 10 times as many people who had poliovirus antibodies as whoever developed any paralytic disease.
Right,
hugely more people had the antibodies.
Right. Do those people have the virus? That's my question. If they had the antibodies, does that mean they had the virus?
I think that the opinion is that it means that they at least once had the virus or bacteria. It's not just the virus, it's bacteria also
right.
where this happens. But whether they have it now is a question virus by virus. Shingles is thought to be from a virus that's been sitting around in you
right.
secretly for decades, tens of years. Tuberculosis can be in you for tens of years. Certainly leprosy can be in you for before you get any disease.
Right. So do you think your wife has the bacteria, the tuberculosis bacteria in her body or just the antibody?
No, but that she did when she was a kid.
And so why do you think with HIV that we can tell from the antibodies that the virus is definitely present?
Well, one is tuberculosis is caused by bacteria, so you need to have the whole cell to still
right.
be there. HIV is a retrovirus, so if the RNA has been converted into complementary DNA and incorporated into a cell, the viral DNA will be there, and
forever.
There's still the perhaps forever.
Right.
New ways of treating, maybe not. And then if the virus is there forever, your word, it has forever the potential to pop out again and start causing trouble.
But when we have a positive antibody test, that doesn't tell us that the virus has been incorporated into your cells.
Correct.
It could just be free virus.
And it doesn't mean that the virus is still there. It just means that the virus was there at one time.
But then we shouldn't use the antibody test to diagnose people with HIV infection. I mean, aren't some of these... I guess what I'm getting at is that some of the criticism...
You've changed subjects more than I have.
No,
you wanted Peter Duesberg, and now you've changed subjects from publishing nonsense to what should happen. Now, when I first lectured on HIV/AIDS in the late 80s, I really thought that the epidemic would continue to grow and
right.
would go into the heterosexual monogamous almost monogamous community and was going to be was going to be more like a medieval plague. And
right.
I guess I was wrong.
Yes.
It hasn't happened. It really hasn't happened.
I guess I'm trying to say two things. So the first point was we use the antibody test for HIV to diagnose people with HIV infection, and yet
we use it as the first screen.
Supplementary
now, then,
test.
Then you do PCR, I'm sure.
No, you do Western blot, which is another antibody test.
I certainly would want to go on if somebody was ELISA or Western blot, two antibody tests, which are cheaper and relatively good. Then I would want to go on to PCR and RT-PCR. Which because this is such a big deal that you would really want to have a stronger understanding of what was going on now in that person.
Right.
Whereas the ELISA test and maybe the Western blot you did would tell you what happened years ago.
Right, but that's what has been done for years now is diagnosing people with infection on the basis of two or three or four antibody tests, ELISA plus Western blot. But the music is telling me that we've come to the end of the hour. And although I don't think we agreed on everything, I think we had a very stimulating discussion. And thank you for the mutual respect.
I hope some of your listeners will find it useful, and
I'm sure
and
they will.
And that it'll help us in the future. The next time I'm going to have this discussion is going to be in September in Siberia. For some reason, the Russians are very concerned about this.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate it. I enjoyed the discussion immensely, and thank you so much for patiently answering my questions. And thank you to the listeners for listening to our show. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.